Case number three. United States versus Mark Fuller. All right, you can proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant Mark Fuller in this matter. Mr. Fuller is entitled to a new hearing on his motion to withdraw his guilty plea based on his trial counsel's actual conflict of interest and ineffective assistance of counsel at the original hearing. As this court is aware, ordinarily to prove ineffective assistance of counsel claims, the defendant must both show incompetent performance and prejudice. However, the Supreme Court recently held in Mickens versus Taylor that this prejudice component is slightly lessened in actual conflict of interest cases. In those cases, the defendant must show that the counsel had an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected his representation. This court has held that an actual conflict of interest is inherent where a client has made a charge of incompetence against his attorney. The reason for this is that such a charge requires counsel to either admit serious ethical violations and submit himself to malpractice or to attack his client's credibility. In this case, trial counsel managed to do both at the hearing on the motion to withdraw. The motion to withdraw in this matter was based on allegations made by Mr. Fuller that his counsel had promised him that he could receive probation as a result of pleading guilty.
Well, I don't know. The word promise never came up, did it?
Yeah. Where does the word promise come from?
The word promise never appears in the record. I think it's an inference that can be made by the entire record. He believed that he could receive probation. That's what
I believe something. That amounts to a promise?
In this situation, I believe so, because the record reflects that he discussed the plea agreement with his counsel. There was a statement in the plea agreement that the government would recommend probation if he qualified for it. In addition,
what's wrong with that?
I'm sorry?
The government would recommend it if he qualified for it.
This is a non-probationable offense, Your Honor. So
I understand that.
So in essence, the plea agreement was incorrect. And in addition to the government being incorrect and the district court being incorrect, because counsel and Mr. Fuller stated at the change of plea hearing that they had discussed the plea agreement, one can infer from that counsel told Mr. Fuller, you could receive probation in this case. In addition, Mr. Fuller says in his pro se letter that his counsel told him that the government will fight for probation for you.
Will do what?
Fight for probation. In other words, that if you plead guilty, the government is going to do what they can to make sure you get probation. From those facts, I believe it can be inferred from the record that he thought he was going to get probation. Granted, the promise was never, it was those words were never used.
Well, they were qualified. At least it would likely fight for probation. He was wrong. I mean, he admitted he hadn't read the sentencing guidelines, but it was always couched in possibilities, wasn't it?
Counsel statements, Your Honor? Yes, counsel statements were always, and actually varied in what he admitted to. First, he admitted that he hadn't looked at the ramifications of a plea agreement and didn't realize that the offense was non-probationable until the probation officer told him so. And he also stated in his argument to the court at the motion to withdraw hearing that the government would not oppose probation, and that was per the plea agreement, when in fact the plea agreement said that the government would recommend probation if he qualified for it.
Let me ask this. Didn't the judge himself advise him that there was a maximum 30-year sentence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't the judge go on to warn him not to base his guilty plea on any promises or predictions of the severity of any sentence?
Aside from those that are made in the plea agreement.
Right.
Correct.
Didn't the the defendant answer to the court that no promises were made to him?
Correct, other than those in the plea agreement, yes.
Right. And did the plea agreement say that he was going to receive probation in writing? Is that what he signed?
It did not say that he would. It said that if he qualified for it, the government would recommend it. So it was not a promise of a sentence, no. And
the plea agreement said that in writing?
That if he qualified, yes.
Right.
Yes. And all of those things are relevant, Your Honor, if the issue on appeal here were whether the district court erred in not allowing Mr. Fuller to withdraw his guilty plea. However, the issue on appeal here is whether counsel provided ineffective assistance of counsel based on his actual conflict of interest. Mr. Fuller is not requesting that this court allow him to withdraw his guilty plea. He's requesting a new hearing on his motion to withdraw his guilty plea with conflict-free counsel.
Did the court also advise him, do you understand and acknowledge that the court is not required to accept any recommendation which may be made?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is free to impose any sentence up to and including the maximum penalties?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that pretty clear?
I believe it's clear, and if this were a Rule 32 issue, I would have an uphill battle arguing against that at this point because the record...
Don't you think you have one now?
Not for the standard... Well, I think we always face that here, Your Honor.
I was just wondering.
It's just the angle of the hill I'm facing at this point.
Very well said.
But my issue on appeal is whether there's an actual conflict of interest.
Well, in that regard, your client doesn't say that he lied to him, his attorney lied to him, did he?
That his attorney lied to him? No, he did not say that.
And in effect, counsel, whether or not he might be subject to some action after this, but he conceded that he didn't look up the sentencing guidelines, did he?
Correct.
So, I mean, the conflict would be that the only conflict I can see is that he would be protecting himself from a malpractice action, right?
And that he attacked his client, Mr. Fuller's, credibility at the hearing by calling him a liar and essentially saying that what he said in his motion, in his pro se letter, wasn't true.
He called him a liar? Is that?
In regards to the statement Mr. Fuller made about the AUSA approaching him immediately before the Rule 11 hearing and saying, we'll fight that, you know, just stick with us, you're a smart guy, and Mr. Fuller's allegations that was inferred to be a promise of
probation. Well, I mean, I suppose that you could say that's a difference of opinion with your facts, but I'm not sure that creates a conflict that warrants the showing that he cannot adequately represent it, does it?
I believe not alone, Your Honor, but I think that reading the entire statement of what trial counsel said, he contradicted Mr. Fuller and called him a liar. And then he went on to say that he knew that he had done nothing wrong, that trial counsel had done nothing wrong, and that he knew he did his job properly. I think that trial counsel was on the defensive here, and the reason for that were the allegations. And in that situation, trial counsel became a witness for the government, essentially arguing the government's case, saying that...
Well, if you were called a liar and you had represented him, would you take it smilingly?
I'm sorry?
Would you laugh at that if the
if
the
my client
convict called you a liar?
Well, I think there's a difference what I would think internally and what I would say to the court on the record where I'm supposed to be representing my client.
Didn't your client testify that the attorney never represented to him that he would receive a probationary sentence?
He made that statement in the affidavit that was filed attached to the motion to withdraw. Correct.
And you don't think it's unusual for the client, the convict, to make false allegations, do you? And when it becomes a question of credibility, do you believe one who has been convicted of a crime more than one who has not ever been convicted by a crime and is an officer of the court? Is that what you're arguing to us?
No, I'm not arguing. I'm not making any credibility arguments whatsoever, as that is the district court's decision in this matter. I'm not arguing credibility at all. I'm arguing the conflict and the prejudice. and the adversely impacting here. And I think that...
But when his reputation is online, because this man does make assertions, don't you think he has an obligation to answer?
I think he has an obligation to state to the court that Mr. Fuller's allegations could create a conflict of interest here, because I would be required as an attorney to either defend myself or defend the client. And in several cases, reported cases by this court has held that, you know, attorneys should say that to the court, and that's it, and not make any further statements.
You're saying that this court has said that he has an obligation, that the client's obligation comes before his obligation to defend his reputation?
I don't think it comes before one way or another.
It doesn't say that, does it? If it does, I'd like to see that case.
No, it doesn't say that, but I see I'm out of time. I'll answer just quickly.
You can answer that.
I believe that there are cases where attorneys have said, Your Honor, this motion creates a conflict of interest, and I will say no more about that, and that's appropriate. And that, I think, is balancing the interest without impugning your client or your own interest at that time.
You don't believe that the court has a right to ask the attorney, are these allegations true that your client has made or false?
I think the court...
In the interest of justice?
I think the court can, because it is a district
can.
Court.
I ask you, don't you think the court has an obligation to do that?
I don't know the answer for that for sure. I think the district court could or can in a situation with the Mickens case where it's no longer the district court's obligation to notice a conflict when it
How
occurs.
How does he secure justice if he doesn't have all of the facts?
I think it depends on the situation. I think at that point... In this situation, I believe that the district court should have said something and asked further counsel, and at that point it became obvious, perhaps appoint another counsel, postpone the hearing. I think the options were out there. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Alice Green for the government in this case. In this appeal, Mr. Fuller is trying to repackage what is really a meritless ineffective assistant argument into an assertion that there was an actual conflict of interest in the proceedings below. And to do so, as we've pointed out in the brief, the public defender is now, who is now representing Mr. Fuller, is inappropriately relying on the appellate record where Mr. Fuller has actually raised new assertions from the ones that he did below, and this court's order finding that his original counsel, Mr. Winnig, would have a conflict representing him in this appeal. The record below shows no actual conflict that adversely affected Mr. Winnig's performance, and this court should reject appellant's contention that the conflict of interest found by this court on appeal is merely an extension of a conflict of interest that appeared below. Looking at the district court record, there's no support in the record that Mr. Winnig was trying to defend himself from any possible claim of malpractice. Mr. Winnig's remarks that are at issue here were made in response to a last-minute letter sent by his client to Judge Shabazz, something that this particular defendant employed in another case, which eventually came to this court in 1993, another last-minute plea that he didn't realize he was going to get such a stiff sentence, and then he started backing off on what he had agreed to in the plea. So there's no evidence at all that Mr. Winnig was trying to respond to a possible claim of malpractice.
Can
he addressed the letter.
There is no evidence of what?
In the record that Mr. Winnig was defending a possible claim of malpractice as the appellant asserts on appeal. He was simply responding to this last-minute letter from his client. And really, Mr. Winnig never disputed the assertions, the unsworn assertions in that letter. He simply indicated that if these remarks were made by Mr. Johnson, he didn't say they weren't made, it would be only a matter of a greeting or salutation. It was not a way to call his client a liar. Even a generous reading of the record does not support the claim that Mr. Winnig disputed his client. He pulled no punches in his argument. In fact, he argued, he even criticized his failure to accurately predict the sentence in this case. There was no inference of any intimidation. There's no lapse in the representation or lack of meaningful adversarial testing in the hearing that was held on the motion. Mr. Winnig argued it based on the sworn affidavit that Mr. Fuller filed with the court, in which he said that his counsel had not made a promise, and that not only was the possibility of probation something that factored into his decision to plead guilty, but also his being able to get acceptance. And of course, Mr. Fuller himself is at fault for failing to get acceptance, since he absconded after the meeting with the probation office in conjunction with the pre-sentence report. The only fair inference based on the record before the court is that Mr. Winnig advanced Mr. Fuller's interests even to his own detriment. Mr. Fuller's new assertions on appeal are a complete turnaround from the assertions he made based in his affidavit and even in the letter that he sent to Judge Shabazz and at the hearing. And they should be disregarded by this court except to the extent that
how they differ.
Well, when Mr. Winnig filed his Andrews brief, Mr. Fuller submitted several responses to that brief.
Can you continue to talk while you're dropping your voice?
Okay. And in those responses, he took a different position. He said, in fact, that he had been promised probation by his counsel, and that is not
Which
at all.
He did not say at the trial.
He did not say that below.
No promise had been
right.
made about
it. Even in the letter that he sent, and certainly not in his sworn affidavit.
And your position is it only came out in response to the Andrews brief on appeal, not at the trial court.
That's correct. And our problem with the position taken on appeal in defendant's brief is that they've really mischaracterized the record by claiming things that Mr. Fuller, in unsworn responses to this court, claimed here, and saying that those were actually made below. And that is just not the case, as we tried to point out in our statement of facts recounting what was said below by Mr. Fuller and what was said below by Mr. Winnig. So our position is that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion to vacate the plea, that there is no basis for sending this case back for the district court to hold a new hearing, that despite the failure to properly predict the plea, it's not ineffective assistance on this record, and that we would ask the court to affirm.
Let me just ask you one other thing. With regard to the Andrews brief, we should deal with the response to the Andrews brief. We should deal with that as we do any argument made that wasn't supported by the trial record. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not sure I understand
the question. The facts asserted by the defendant in response to the Andrews brief, how should we deal with that?
I think on appeal you dealt with it exactly as you should have. It would have, at that point, when Mr. Fuller was making these assertions against Mr. Winnig, it would have been inappropriate to allow Mr. Winnig to proceed on the appeal. But as the court's order pointed out, that finding did not mean that there was an actual conflict below. And when you look at the facts below, we believe that there is no support for a finding such as that. Is there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want half a minute or somebody to answer?
Yes, sir.
Half a minute, please. Or a minute, because we asked you a lot of questions.
I think I'll specifically tailor my comments to using materials not in the district court record. And as the court is aware, there's currently a motion to strike a portion of my brief pending, which the court ruled they would consider with the merits of the brief. In my response to that motion, I said that it was technically correct that letter was not a portion of the district court record. However, it was relied on by the panel who decided the Andrews portion of this case. I do not have a problem with it being struck from the record or from my appendix. In that same vein, then, I believe that none of the materials used in the Andrews process should be a part of this record. If we're going to base it solely on the record in front of the district court, which my brief does, I don't mention any of Mr. Fuller's responses in my argument. None of his statements are in there. The statements are solely based on counsel's statements at the motion to withdraw hearing, the motion to withdraw itself, and Mr. Fuller's pro se letter.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement.